Today, we are going to talk about a few very short texts preserved in the Apocrypha about the figure Daniel. Daniel is known, of course, from the Hebrew Bible as well. The book of Daniel in the Hebrew Bible has both Aramaic and Hebrew in it. The stories that are preserved in the Apocrypha are preserved in Greek, but some of these little stories preserved in Greek in the Apocrypha may have been written originally in Aramaic and Hebrew. And in fact, what I'm going to suggest is that they probably were written originally in a Semitic language. And while they circulated in Greek, they might have actually derived from the region of Judea. And this becomes very important in properly understanding the significance of these little texts. Before we talk about the what's called the additions to Daniel, I'm going to say a few words about the figure himself. Now, Daniel is incredibly popular in the Second Temple period, considered like a hero, a superhero even of his time. And there are many, many stories and legends, both oral and written, that are circulating in Judea, in Hebrew and Aramaic, like I said, in diaspora, in Greek. Many, many stories are circulating in many regions in various languages about Daniel, and that tells us that he was incredibly popular. Like another diasporan figure, Joseph, Daniel is considered the perfect diasporan success story. He reaches the highest possible echelons of professional success, is beloved to the most powerful king in the known world at the time, considered not only totally and perfectly devoted to his ancestral law, but also very attractive. And we talked last week in the case of Judith, how in the ancient world, there is no tension between physical perfection and intellectual, spiritual, philosophical perfection. Today we have the cultural stereotype of the blonde bimbo or someone who's very attractive, but maybe not so smart. In the ancient world, these things are not at all in tension with one another. Joseph, Daniel, these are both diasporan success stories. They're both figures who were beloved, particularly by diasporan Jews who saw in these figures an example for themselves and a model for themselves, probably in a way which Judean Jews found to be problematic. And we're going to discuss that later in the hour. So while the diasporan figure of Daniel preserved in the Tanakh is perfectly pious, and we're going to see that there are actually some things about him that no one else in Tanakh does, he also expresses no interest in returning to the land of Israel while he is in exile in Babylonia. And yet, he is the first and only figure in Tanakh who is credited with praying regularly to God three times a day. The patriarchs do not do this. Moses does not do this. David does not do this. Daniel, in Daniel 6, we are told, regulates prayer. He's the first one. He's praying three times a day. And what is he doing when he's praying three times a day? He's praying facing Jerusalem. So it's not that he is not interested in Jerusalem or Judea or its temple. It's not that he's not devoted to it. We just don't see an expression of any intention to return, but he has devotion. And this is the tightrope that diasporan Jews we've been discussing over the past few weeks have been walking, because they do express fealty. They do express loyalty to the land of Israel, to Jerusalem and its temple, but it doesn't mean necessarily that they're putting plans in place to return. Not necessarily that Daniel could, but we don't see that wish articulated. Daniel's also arguably the last recipient of an explicit miracle in the Tanakh, being saved from a fiery furnace, or his companions are saved. But Daniel, in many ways, what I would call him, in many ways, the first Jew, not the first Israelite, not the first member of the Abrahamic family, but he's the last major figure of the Hebrew Bible, but in some ways the first Jew, because what he does and the practice attributed to him seems in many ways rabbinic or proto-rabbinic in a way that we don't see with other earlier figures in the Tanakh. So he's one of the last figures in Tanakh, but one of the first or proto-rabbinic figures regulating prayer. And we're going to get into the details of what I mean as we discuss these texts further. But there is a big problem with Daniel, and that is that he's so disconnected from Judea. And so Second Temple traditions deal with this challenge in a particular way. What do you do with Daniel, someone who's so pious and so successful in the diaspora and doesn't, on the one hand, doesn't ever sin, and yet seems to be like very much truncated from the world of Judea? So we're going to see that Second Temple traditions deal with this in a particular way, but I want to jump to the rabbinic period, by which I mean after 70 CE, when the temple falls, and just say a few brief words about what I think the rabbis do with Daniel. And I think this is important to understand when we go back to the Second Temple traditions. I think that what the rabbis do with Daniel is that they relegate him to the background. Now, again, in the Second Temple period, Daniel is enormously popular. There's no question about it. Again, we have many, many stories about Daniel. Some of these were clearly circulating orally before they were written down in various languages from various regions. This tells us I'm trying to think of a contemporary example, but he's like the Superman of the ancient world. I mean, he's utterly perfect. He's totally successful. Everybody loves him, Gentile and Jew alike. He doesn't fail at anything that he does. And yet, as popular as he is in the Second Temple period, the rabbis take certain tropes, certain motifs from the most famous stories about Daniel, and they take those stories and they replace Daniel with Abraham. So again, this is my theory. I haven't published it yet. I haven't seen it articulated elsewhere. So I'm sharing this with my, I don't know how many people are on this call, 200 or so, most 150 of my best friends. So you're hearing this theory. If you look at, let's say, the 5th century CE rabbinic collection, Genesis Rabbah, chapter 38, which recalls the story of Abraham in the fiery furnace, you will see striking parallels with Daniel chapter 3. I don't think this is a coincidence. Hold on one second. I'm going to show you a little bit of this. I don't want to spend so much time in the rabbinic period. Here's a Genesis Rabbah 38:13. And here's the story of Abraham being thrown into the fiery furnace. It's a very, very funny story. Again, I'm not going to read it word for word. It's actually not in your source sheet, but I'm happy to send it to anybody who wants to take a closer look at it. But Abraham here is not only being thrown into the furnace. That's not the only link with Daniel. What really links Abraham to Daniel is the one quality that is so at the foreground of the Daniel stories, and that is his bold cleverness. And in this midrashic legend, Abraham doesn't just get thrown into the furnace by Nimrod, but he has a clever debate where he uses logic to explain to Nimrod that Nimrod is worshiping nothing. When the people say to Nimrod, let's worship fire, Abraham says, no, let's worship water because it extinguishes fire. And Nimrod's like, that's a great idea. Let's worship water. And then Abraham's like, well, let's just worship the clouds, which provide water. And Nimrod's like, yeah, let's worship the clouds. And Abraham is obviously playing him. Let's worship the winds that scatter the clouds. And Nimrod's like, yeah, great idea. Let's worship the winds. Abraham's like, wait a second. Let's worship humans who are filled with wind or air. Nimrod realizes he's being played and he says, you're just speaking words. I only worship fire and I'm going to throw you into it. And so this is a very humorous midrash. It's a very funny midrash, but I'm sharing it with you because I want you to note that certain rabbinic stories about Abraham, I think, actually have their derivation in the Daniel stories. There's another example I'll share with you briefly, and that has to do with the regulation of prayer. So when we're told in Daniel chapter 6, that I'm going to go back to this document. When we're told in Daniel chapter 6 that Daniel goes to his house regularly and he has windows in the upper room facing Jerusalem. Please, everybody, mute yourselves. That'd be very helpful. Thank you. And he gets down on his knees 3 times a day to pray to his God, just as he has done previously. We don't have anyone else earlier in Tanakh doing this. And yet the tradition preserved in the Bavli, in the Babylonian Talmud, tells us that no, in fact, it was Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob who established these 3 daily prayers. So the question here is, why? Why do I think this is significant? I think that Abraham is presented in rabbinic literature as the first Jew, right? Our tradition doesn't just go back to the post-exilic period, the time of Daniel, where these things became normative, regular prayer becomes normative, and the regular reading of scriptures likewise becomes established. No, our tradition goes all the way back continuously to the time of Abraham. So I think there's something very significant going on here with how Daniel's stories enter into the tradition of rabbinic literature, and yet Daniel himself is relegated into the background. Now, Daniel is a diasporan figure. He doesn't end up in Judea. When you look, however, at the late Second Temple traditions about Daniel, you see something very different. So I was just talking to you about post 70 CE rabbinic literature. But now let's go back. Let's go back to the late Second Temple period. And I'm also going to ask if you could save the chat comments just for the second half of the class, because it keeps popping up. If you could just save your comments towards the last 10-15 minutes, that'd be very helpful, because it keeps popping up I would appreciate that. Thank you. Okay. So let's talk about these additions that are preserved in the Greek book of Daniel, preserved in the Septuagint. So we have these additions. They're called the additions to Daniel. If you have the Jewish annotated Apocrypha, you will see that these additions to Daniel are the prayer of Azariah, which actually has a lot of names. It's also called the Song of the Three Friends, the Song of the Three Companions, the Prayer of the Three Companions. You could make any combination you want of that. The Book of Susanna, Shoshana, and Bell and the Dragon. And you might look and see who wrote that commentary to the Bell and the Dragon and ask her a lot of questions if you are curious. Okay. Anyway, that's me. I wrote that commentary. Okay. So let's talk about these additions. You know that they circulated in Greek. You know that they're preserved in the Greek book of Daniel in the Septuagint. That doesn't mean that they're diasporan, and it doesn't mean that they're originally written in Greek. And what I'm going to suggest, and we did this with Greek Esther. Remember, when we talked about Greek Esther, we said the Greek version of Esther seems more focused on Judea than the Hebrew version of Esther. And the Greek version of Esther can be read as a polemic to diasporan Greek-speaking Jewry. I think something very similar could be happening here, where you have the Hebrew/Aramaic book of Daniel preserved in the Tanakh, which doesn't seem to be very focused on Judea, whereas the additions to Daniel circulating in Greek subtly denigrate the diaspora. Subtly and not so subtly denigrate the diaspora. And I think that there is room to argue that these are maybe not necessarily obvious polemics against diasporan Jewry, but that they do have derivation from Judea. And so now I'm going to share our source sheet. Hold on a second. All right, so now you should see Azariah and the Three Companions, which again is preserved in the Septuagint between chapter 3, verse 23 and verse 24. So in the scene where Azariah and the Three Companions are thrown into the fiery furnace, and I have the story here in your story sheet, but we're not going to do it word for word. This is a very, very famous story, and you probably have some sketch of it in your minds, that Nebuchadnezzar tosses these three friends of Daniel into the fire, and they emerge unscathed, and Nebuchadnezzar learns from this that the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these Jewish courtiers, is the one true God, the great God of not just the Jewish people, but the universe. Fine. Now I want to show you the Greek insertion that appears after the story that we have in the Hebrew version. And this looks to me like it's very, very, very Judean. I've never seen a document like this that derived from the diaspora, but again, it's circulating in Greek. So this content, which parallels many psalms, many Tehillim that are in the Tanakh, at first seems very boring and straightforward. They utter this praise of God. Blessed are you, O Lord, God of our ancestors, worthy of praise. you are just in all you have done. Now remember, they're in exile and there is no temple right now. Nebuchadnezzar, the king in Daniel 3, has destroyed the temple. So this is the exilic period. You've executed true judgments in all you've brought upon us and upon Jerusalem, the holy city of our ancestors. By the way, this phrase holy city is quite rare in Second Temple literature. By a true judgment, you've brought all this upon us because of our sins. We have sinned. We have broken your law in turning away from you. In all matters, we have sinned grievously. We have not obeyed your commandments. We have not kept them or done what you've commanded us for our own good. I think there's a real emphasis here on the sinful nature of the exiled community. And remember, this text is written in the second century BCE after the second temple. For three centuries, the second temple has been established. And is up and running, but there's still an active diaspora in the West and in the East. And so what would it have meant for somebody to have written this 3 centuries after the Second Temple is built for Jews who are speaking Greek? So all that you have brought upon us and all that you've done to us, you've done by true judgment. You've handed us over to our enemies, to an unjust king. And now we cannot open our mouths. We, your servants who worship you, have become a shame and a reproach. We, O Lord, have become fewer than any other nation. We are brought low this day in all the world because of our sins. In our day, we have no ruler or prophet or leader, no burnt offerings or sacrifice. No. So I think the implication is that for these figures forced in exile, if there was any possibility to return, of course they would return. If there was any possibility to go back to their temple, of course they would go back to their temple. They're only in the diaspora because they're forced to be in the diaspora. But their very existence in the diaspora reminds them of their sins and of their shame and of their despair. Now, this does not correlate with the second century BCE reality where the diaspora is thriving. And of course, there is a possibility that these diasporan Jews can return, and they are not. And so what is the subtle message being conveyed to these Greek-speaking Jews in the diaspora who might be reading this and reciting it and repeating it? I think that this puts a very negative light on diasporan Jewish life, suggesting now that you can go back and you're not. You continue to live out the shameful identity of those diasporan Jews who lived in the 6th century BCE. Now, this denigration of the diaspora, I think, carries through in other additions to Daniel. I want to skip Bell. It's a very fun text. And, you know, like I said, if you have the JAA, you should read it. You should read my commentary. But I want to skip it, and I'm going to hopefully come back to it, because I want to go back to, not go back, but I want to go to a very famous figure. And her name is Susanna, Rose, Shoshana in Hebrew. Now, the story is known as Shoshana, but she is not really the main figure, the main protagonist of the story. Really, the protagonist of the story is Daniel. I was thinking about adding her story to last week's class when we talked about novellas, because we have all these novellas that feature a woman at the center. We have Judith, Esther. I didn't even talk about the woman in 2 Maccabees 7, which I think is a standalone story, the mother of the 7 sons who are all martyred, and later she's identified with Hannah, but she's not named Hannah in the 2nd century BCE. And again, 2 Maccabees chapter 7 is about this woman. I think that story was added by the author. I think it's circulated on its own. So that's another novella featuring a woman. And Joseph and Asenath, we sort of talked about, also featuring a woman. And I didn't add Shoshana to last week's story because there's no way we would have gotten to it. But this is yet another example of a little novella, a little story that features a pious woman at its center. However, the real protagonist here is Daniel. And for that reason, Shoshana doesn't have a three-dimensional personality the way that other figures like Judith, let's say, has a very, very developed, well-developed personality, not just a cookie cutter, just perfect and uninteresting. I feel bad saying that about Susanna, but I do find her both perfect and uninteresting, because the point is not that she has this internal world that's very well-developed. The point is that her crisis allows us to see all the ways in which Daniel helps the vulnerable. around him. And so the story is this, and I'm going to focus on the elements of the story that are denigrating towards the diaspora, because the argument that I'm making today is that these Greek additions to Daniel should not be viewed as reflective of a diasporan approach. In fact, I think that they're quite negative towards the diaspora, and I'm not convinced at all that they're diasporan. Okay, so the story of Susanna is this, and again, she's very two-dimensional. I even imagine her sometimes as a poster cutout board, you know, like you could go to some like tourist attraction and pose with a poster cutout of Barack Obama. So like, I imagine her like as a poster cutout going like this, because like, that's all we get from Susanna. She's just, I don't want to make you biased, so I'm going to refrain from saying more, I suppose. But she's meant to be a caricature, I think. She's perfect. She's beautiful. That's it. Okay. There was a man living in Babylon whose name was Jehoiakim. He married the daughter of Chilkiah. Her name was Susanna. She was very beautiful. She feared the Lord. Great. Her parents were righteous. They had trained their daughter according to the law of Moses. Very interesting. Whatever could that mean? Torah Moshe would be the Hebrew. Nomos, Moises would be the Greek. Jehoiakim was very rich. And remember, there are no tensions between these things in the ancient world. Being rich, being beautiful, being pious, that all goes together. They're not in tension necessarily. And he had a fine garden adjoining the house. That becomes important. The Jews used to come to him because he was the most honored of them all. That year, two elders from the people were appointed as judges. And remember, we're in exile right now. Concerning them, the Lord said, this is a verse, I believe, from Zechariah, maybe chapter 5. Wickedness, you'll have to look it up because I'm not sure. Wickedness came forth from Babel, from elders who were judges, who were supposed to govern the people. These men were frequently at Jehoiakim's house. So basically, Jehoiakim has this beautiful villa, lots of gardens. Imagine this gorgeous little estate. And two elders who were appointed as judges show up because it's like the place to hang out. Jehoiakim's place maybe has a pool table, really good snacks, a nice pool in the back. Like, you know, where else would you want to go? And so also they judged people there. We're going to get to that. And all who had a case to be tried would go do it at Jehoiakim's house. People would come and go, but they would leave at noon for a siesta nap. They would go home after lunch. And Susanna, who lived obviously in the house with her husband, Jehoiakim, would go into her husband's garden. Everybody would sort of leave after lunch, and she would go into the garden. And every day, the two elders used to see her going in and walking about, and they began to lust for her. They suppressed their consciences, and they turned away their eyes from looking to heaven or remembering their duty to administer justice. But they were overwhelmed with passion. They didn't tell each other of their distress. They were ashamed to disclose their lustful desire. So now, again, we're focusing on what is this story telling us about the diaspora. Now, these two leaders are corrupt. They're obsessed with their lustful desire for Susanna. They're not focused on properly judging the people as they should. And just in case this isn't subtle enough, the author links it with a biblical verse saying, when the prophet Zechariah says wickedness comes forth from Babel, it's a reference to corrupt leaders in exile. And so now we have a system of corruption, of oppressing the perfectly innocent and pious. And so anyway, they both independently hatch a plan to seduce Susanna. One day they say to each other, let's go home, it's time for lunch. They both pretend to leave, but then they're both sort of circling back to the garden because they have the same plan. And they both see each other and like, uh-oh, why'd you come back? Uh-oh, why'd you come back? Why'd you come back? Finally, they both confess to each other. Oh, you were going to seduce her? I was going to seduce her. Hey, why don't we do that together? See, it's really creepy. It's not supposed to be okay. It's not supposed to feel good. It's supposed to get a rise out of it. Like, this is corrupt. This is gross. This is sinful. Anyway, so what do? They know that she's bathing outside in the garden, and they're hiding and they're watching her. And she says to her maids, bring me olive oil and ointment, shut the garden door. I'm going to be by myself now. And then when the maids go in, the two elders go and they run to her. They're about to assault her, and they blackmail her. And they say, look, if you don't sleep with us, we are going to accuse you of adultery. And so Susanna groans. And this is also extremely Hellenistic, I think. Remember with Judith, we had this extensive description of her getting dressed and undressed, and yet she's totally pious. It's like a kosher way of sort of making the story a little bit lewd and keeping the reader reading, but also like not compromising the integrity of the main character's piety. And so here, the reader might be a little guilty of thinking some thoughts, but Susanna herself is not guilty of anything. She says, I'm completely trapped. If I do this, it will mean death for me if I do not. And again, the subtlety, this writer is a fine writer, but subtlety is not the focus of this writer, right? Like subtlety is not a thing in this book. Concerning from then, the Lord said, wickedness came forth from Babylon. Like there's no work for the reader to do here, because we are being told exactly who is what. So these judges are totally corrupt and wicked. And in case you're curious about the crisis that Susanna is enduring, she gives it to you on a silver platter. She tells the reader what the problem is. I am completely trapped. For if I do this, it will mean death for me. If I do not, I cannot escape your hands. I remember when I was very young, and I would sometimes be home from school, say I had a fever or whatever, and I would watch a soap opera. And you know, let's say I was 9 or 10, just flipping through the channels, and I would find a soap opera that I hadn't watched in 6 months from the last time that I was sick. And nothing happens in these stories. Time moves very, very, very slowly. But one funny feature of these stories is that the characters are constantly reviewing what has happened. Oh, Lenora, you are the identical twin sister that was in a coma, and you've been pretending to be her as a parent of our secret child. Like, you don't have to say it every scene. But in any case, I feel like Susanna is like, if I do this, it will mean death for me. If I do not, I cannot escape your hand. So the reader's being told exactly what's at stake, but also that she's totally pious. This is absolutely not the fault or responsibility of Susanna. She's totally innocent, and she's put in an impossible position. Susanna cries out with a loud voice, and the two elders shout against her, and they accuse her of adultery. One of them runs and opens the garden door. The people in the house hear shouting in the garden. They run to see what's going on, and the elders claim that Susanna tried to seduce them. And so they put her on trial, and they put her on trial on pain of death so that she might be executed by these very judges who attacked her. And so she's put on trial. And again, we have this description of beauty as being a representation of perfect piety. She comes to her own trial, and she was veiled because she's so pious, but the scoundrels order her to be unveiled so that they might feast their eyes on her beauty. And everyone who sees her is weeping, and they stand before her and they accuse her. While we were walking in the garden alone, this woman came in with two maids. They shut the garden door. They dismissed the maids, and they go through the whole story. Now, again, my point here is that this story can be read as a denigration of the diaspora. Without proper leadership, without the temple, without temple administration, without proper priestly service, without the system of leadership that we have in Judea, this is what you're going to get, folks. You're going to get corruption. You're going to get dysfunction. You're going to get people at the top who are motivated by greed and lust and not by justice. Susanna cries out with a loud voice, oh, eternal God, you know what is secret and are aware of all things before they come to be. You know that these men have given false evidence. You know that I'm about to die. And the Lord hears her cry. And that very moment, God stirs up the Holy Spirit of a young lad named Daniel. And again, the thing about Daniel, the main characteristic that Daniel has that you see also in stories about Abraham, that parallel stories about Daniel, is that he's very, very clever. And so just as she's about to be brought to her own unjust death, he shouts in a dramatic voice, I want no part in shedding this woman's blood. And all the people are like, who are you? Now, remember, he's a very popular figure in Second Temple literature. But in these stories, he's not, in this particular story, he's not necessarily a leader, right? He's a young lad. This is an origin story of Daniel. So he's not yet a courtier in the court of the king. He's not second in command. He's not like a parallel to Joseph. This is an early origin story of Daniel. And he's just a kid. He's a teenager, maybe, a young lad. And so taking his stand among them, he says, are you such fools, O Israelites, as to condemn a daughter of Israel without examination and without learning the facts? Return to court, for these men have given false evidence. And so what does Daniel do? He says to them, separate them from each other and I will examine them. And he separates them. And by the way, this story becomes cited in the Babylonian Talmudic tractate Sanhedrin for how to interrogate witnesses. Daniel interrogates the witnesses separately and finds inconsistencies in these stories. And there's a lot of wonderful wordplay in the Greek, but it doesn't mean it was originally written in Greek, because scholars note that you can mimic wordplay even in translation. There are interesting examples of translated works that mimic wordplay, but it doesn't mean necessarily it was written originally in Greek. But anyway, there's a lot of wordplay going on here with the Greek. So Daniel asks one of them, under what tree did you see them being together? And the elder says, under a mastic tree. And Daniel says, very well, this lie has cost you your head, for the angel of God has received the sentence from God and will immediately cut you in two. Cut you in two is the same word as the mastic tree. Wait, where does he say it? Where's the other tree? I don't know why I can't find it. But anyway, they say different trees. Oh yeah, here it is. Okay. Tell me, under what tree did you catch them being intimate? And he says, under an evergreen oak. Very well, this lie has cost you also your head, for an angel of God is waiting with his sword to split you in two. And again, this is a pun on evergreen oak. And so he determines that they don't have the same story. Although I am not an expert in botany, and I could see myself in a situation where I have no idea what tree I see anything happening. You know, I don't know, but maybe they really knew their trees in ancient Babylonia. Then the whole assembly raised a great shout and blessed God, who saves those who hope in him. And they took action against the two elders, because out of their own mouths, Daniel had convicted them of bearing false witness. They did to them as they had wickedly planned to do to their neighbor. Acting in accordance with the law of Moses, remember, this is exactly how Susanna herself is described, and her family. They put them to death. Thus, innocent blood was spared that day. So while it is possible in exile to live in accordance with the law of Moses, the structure of leadership that exists in exile is not conducive to supporting this loyalty to the law of Moses. So you have piety in exile, but not necessarily in the structure of leadership, which is critiqued as being as emanating evil. Chilkiah and his wife praised God for their daughter Susanna. So did her husband Jehoiakim. She was found innocent of a shameful deed. But the most important verse in this whole little story is, from that day onwards, Daniel had a great reputation among the people, because the point of the story is not really anything about Shoshana. That's not really the story, the story's focus. The goal of the story is to tell us, where does Daniel come from? What is his origin story? What was he like as a child? And remember, there are also likewise problems with Abraham's origin story in the Hebrew Bible. He doesn't have one. We don't know how he discovers God. How does he assemble a following? The rabbis fill in all those things for us with stories with interlocutors such as Nimrod, stories about how he and Sarah acquired 70 or various followers. You wouldn't call them converts, but people who joined their little community. And so here, likewise, from that day onwards, Daniel had a great reputation among the people. This is an origin story for Daniel, but Daniel is set up not as being part of the system of Jewish leadership, but in a way that contrasts him with the system of Jewish leadership in the diaspora, so that Daniel redeems the people of exile from suffering under this oppressive leadership. And so the presentation of Jewish leadership in the diaspora in the Book of Susanna is really quite negative. So now we've looked at two additions. We've looked at the Azarian Three Companions, which links diaspora living with the sins of the people in a way that I think suggests a contemporary second century BCE critique of diaspora in Judaism. We've looked at Susanna, which depicts leadership in the exile as a system that's inherently corrupt. And now I'm going to take you to Bel and the Dragon. I'm not going to argue that Bel is as explicitly anti-diasporan leadership or diasporan Jewry as the other two texts, but it is very interesting, and I think it's worth taking a look at for, let's say, 5 or 10 minutes, and then we'll wrap up for conversation. So Bel and the Dragon is a series of a few little stories. They're vignettes. They're not even stories. They're vignettes. They're scenes. When I say vignette, I mean these could have been performed as little scenes on a stage. Maybe they were. there is actually a lot of stage direction in these texts. And each of these stories opens with the king saying, Daniel, why don't you worship my God? Why do you worship the unseen God, the creator God that you claim to have been chosen by? Why don't you worship my idols? And Daniel says, well, I'm going to show you why I believe that your idol is in fact not deified at all. Your idol is just clay and bronze. And so Daniel does something to demonstrate the emptiness of this God. And the king declares Daniel's God to be the one true God. Now, what's interesting is that the end of Bell and the Dragon, I'm not going to go straight there, but I just want to zoom there for 1 second. The end of Bell and the Dragon has Daniel in a moment of total mortal danger where he's about to be killed in the lion's den. And this is a developed version of Daniel chapter 6 where he's in the lion's den. This is a different, very different version of the lion's den story. So Daniel is in mortal danger. He's about to be killed by very hungry lions. And at that moment, he's saved, and he's saved by a Judean prophet. He's saved by the prophet, randomly, perhaps, Habakkuk. Habakkuk saves Daniel. Otherwise, he would have been eaten by the lions, but the Judean prophet Habakkuk saves him. We're going to go back to that in a few minutes. Let's start here. These are very fun little vignettes. They're meant to entertain. They're meant to delight. And I think that they really do a great job of achieving their sort of entertainment goals. The king says to Daniel in the first vignette, why don't you worship Bel? Bel is probably a version of Baal, the ancient Near Eastern Mesopotamian god. Daniel says, I don't revere idols made with hands. I only revere the living God who created heaven and earth and has dominion over all living creatures. The king says, but why don't you think that Bel is a living god? Don't you know that we feed him every day and he eats the food, thus proving that he's animate, that he has some life in him? And Daniel laughs and says, do not be deceived. Remember, he's clever. That's the defining characteristic of Daniel, is that he's so clever. Daniel laughs and says, do not be deceived, O king. This thing is only clay inside and bronze outside. It never ate or drank anything. The king gets angry and he calls the priests of Baal or Bel and says to them, tell me what's going on, because I love my Daniel. And if Daniel says that this God is not eating, then what's the story here? You need to prove that he's really eating. You need to prove that we're right. And there is reflected in this demand that the king makes of the priest, a love and a respect for Daniel. Daniel says, all right, king, we're going to do a test. We're going to test the God. There are 70 priests of Baal, plus their wives and their children. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to set out food, and the priests lay out the plan. We're going to set out food at night. We're going to shut the door. We're going to seal it. And when you return in the morning, you're going to see that Bel ate the food. If you don't see that Bel ate the food, if the food is still there, we will die. You can execute us. But if you see, and this is such a sort of irresponsible plan, but if you see that the food has not been eaten, then you've got to execute Daniel. They were unconcerned. They were very confident in their plan. Why? This is so great, because this is extremely Hellenistic. Like, you don't see anything like this in the Hebrew Bible. Because there's a trap door. And that's why I said, you could almost imagine this being performed on a stage. There's a trap door. So they weren't going in through the main door that they had sealed. They were going into a basement, and they were pulling down a trap door from the ceiling, climbing into the room and grabbing all the food for themselves. And that's how they ate their delicious dinner. So after they go out, the king sets out the food for Bel. Daniel orders his servants to bring ashes, and they scatter them throughout the whole temple in the presence of the king alone. They go out, they shut the door, they seal it with the king's signet, they depart. During the night, the priests come as usual, right? Because how do they do it? They do it in the trap door. They come into the room, they eat and they drink all the food that had been laid out for Bel. Next morning, the king gets up and the king says, are the seals of the front door unbroken? And he says, well, yeah, they are unbroken. But they open up the doors, and the king looks at the table and there's no food. And he says, you know what, Daniel, you're wrong. Bel ate the food we laid out for him. But Daniel says, look down, look at the floor. What do you see? The king says, I see footprints of men and women and children. And suddenly he realizes there was a trap door and they were getting into the room and eating all that food themselves, not through the front door, but through the floor. The king is enraged and he arrests the priests and their wives and children. They show him the secret doors through which they had used. Maybe it wasn't on the floor. Maybe it was just a secret door from another part of the room. And he puts them to death and he gives Bel over to Daniel. And this is a very important detail. How does the story end? What does Daniel do? He destroys the god and he destroys its temple. Not just the god, but the temple itself. Now, this could be an allusion to Daniel's devotion to a different temple in Jerusalem, but it's not explicit. It's not explicit. But Daniel destroys the temple as well. And that's vignette number one. Cute little story where Daniel proves the worthlessness and the non-existence of the Babylonian god Bel. Now, parallel story number two. And after this, we'll talk for 2 minutes and we'll wrap up so we got time for conversation. Okay, story number two, there's a dragon. Now in Hebrew, not in Hebrew, in Greek, it's drakon, which can mean snake. So drakon in Greek means snake. The translation in the NRSV is dragon. Was it a dragon? Was it a snake? It was some live creature. It was a live creature. So we're going to say dragon, recognizing that it might've been a snake, at least to readers in the late Second Temple period. Okay, so there's some dragon, some animal that the Babylonians revered. The king said to Daniel, you can't deny, this is a living God. And Daniel says, well, I worship the Lord, my God. So give me permission, okay? I will kill this dragon without a sword or club. The king says, yeah, sure, show me. So what does he do? He takes pitch, fat, and hair and boils them and makes cakes, feeds it to the dragon, and the dragon eats them, poor little dragon, and his stomach bursts. And Daniel says, see what you have been worshiping. Now, this reminds me a lot, again, going back to Genesis Rabbah, when later on, I didn't show this this segment to you, but in the same passage where Nimrod and Avram are arguing, Avram destroys the idols of his father. So again, it's very, very similar to later Midrashim about Abraham. Okay, when the Babylonians hear what Daniel has done, they're furious. And what do they say? And this, again, is a verb that comes, I think we discussed very briefly last week. This verb is in the book of Esther, mityahed. The king has become a Jew. Judaizein in Greek. He has become a Jew. What does this mean? Would require a totally different lecture. Does this mean he has become an ethno-nationalist member of Judea? Or does this mean that he is a Jew? I will put that on the back burner. I'm going to punt that question. But it means the king has become a member of Daniel's community. He has destroyed Bel. He's killed the dragon. He slaughtered the priests. And they say, you know what, king? Hand Daniel over to us so we can kill him, or we're going to kill you. The king is flipping out. He doesn't know what to do. So he hands Daniel over to them. They throw him into the lions. And again, this is a version, a very Hellenistic version of Daniel 6, which is the very famous story of Daniel being thrown to the lions. Then there. He's there for 6 days. The lions are chilling. They're very hungry. They're not given any food. I like how usually they're given 2 human bodies and 2 sheep. It's an interesting thing to feed lions on a regular basis. But anyway, these are very hungry lions and they don't bother Daniel for 6 days. But, you know, eventually these lions are going to find Daniel and rip him to shreds. And so this is how Bel and the Dragon ends. And it's totally out of left field. I mean, completely unrelated to anything that we've seen so far in the story. The prophet Habakkuk was making dinner one night. He was a very domestic guy and he liked to make his lamb stew. Maybe he would have it with some beer and he had broken bread in a bowl and he's just chilling, minding his own business at 6 p.m. and he's expecting to settle in with Netflix. No, I'm not going to be funny. I'm just going to read. Okay. And so he broke bread into a bowl and he's going to the field. He's bringing it to his workers and the angel of the Lord comes to him and gives him a prophetic message. Take the food that you have, Habakkuk, go to Babylon and save Daniel, right? Because if you bring this food to the lions, then they'll eat that food and then Daniel will be eaten. Habakkuk says, no way, sir. I've never been to Babylon and I know nothing about this. This is not my problem. And so what do you think he's saying here? The welfare of the diaspora and Jews, whether these are pious Jews or sinful Jews, not my business. Not my problem. This is a different community and I have no responsibility over these diasporan Jews. So the angel of the Lord, this is just a great detail, takes him by the crown of his head, carries him by the hair, and they fly through the air from Judea with the speed of wind and sets him down in Babylon, right over the den. Just the angel grabs him. They go shooting up into the atmosphere, and they fly across thousands of, they traverse thousands of miles, and they end up in the lion's den. And Habakkuk, who probably was like annoyed because he had, you know, plans to just settle in his pajamas that night, was like, Daniel, Daniel, take the food that God has sent you. And Daniel says, you've remembered me. Oh, Daniel eats, not the lions, which is a strange detail because you would think that that would be for the lions. You've remembered me, O God, and have not forsaken those who love you. Daniel eats. I guess the lions are docile at this point. The angel of God immediately returns Habakkuk to his own place. On the seventh day, the king comes to mourn Daniel, to get his corpse and take it out of this den. And he says, oh my gosh, Daniel, you're alive. You're here. What's going on? And the king shouts again, just like he did at the end of the first vignette, you are great, O Lord, the God of Daniel. There is no other besides you. He pulls Daniel out, and he throws into den those who accused Daniel, and those who accused the king of becoming a Jew, and they were instantly eaten before his eyes. So like, what are these stories? What, you know, all these little additions, again, circulating in Greek, preserved in Greek. You know, I think when it comes to Azariah and the three companions and Susanna, Shoshana, there's a clear negative bent against the diaspora. Belle is more interesting, not necessarily more interesting, but more of a question in terms of the approach towards the diaspora. You don't see an explicit negative polemic against the diaspora, but salvation derives from the diaspora. Salvation derives from Judea, even when those Judean leaders are not necessarily expressing genuine concern for the welfare of these diasporan Jews. I want to make sure that we have time to share comments, impressions, and questions. I have seen the chat, it has been active, and I have not read these comments. You know, we have 170 people on this call, so I'm a little hesitant to say just shout out questions because I'm worried that people will be talking over each other. So I'm going to take 1 minute to look at some of these questions, but you know, some of these I did address in the past week. How do you understand, in the past 3 weeks, how do you understand the origin of the Septuagint? Why is it called the Septuagint? So I think we have discussed these big picture questions. The Septuagint is a collection that was produced over the course of three centuries by different authors. I think I want to focus, you know, if you have big picture questions, that's great. I don't expect anybody to be memorizing the lectures that I've given so far, but why don't you send those big picture questions to me, to my email. Let's focus on the Daniel stories. So let's try to see if we can do this in a sort of systematic way. If someone has a question, you could unmute yourself and ask. Let's try it that way.
Question. So some of these, like Habakkuk being lifted up by his hair and being traveled. So that happens to Yechezkel.
Right.
And in the opposite direction, Yechezkel is taken from Babel to Jerusalem.
Oh, that's great.
So the Greek story just mushes it up and turns it upside down. That's very interesting. The parallels in the Shoshana story to Yehuda and Tamar, where she is, you know, and she's, you know, it's the seduction and the accusation, and she's going to be burned at the stake, and so go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely important. I think that both of these stories, but especially Shoshana, has biblical allusions and biblical language that's borrowed from earlier Septuagint texts. With Habakkuk, there are even later manuscripts. This is very interesting. I actually wasn't going to share this, but there are later manuscripts of Bel and the Dragon that have an opening title that attributes the authorship of the text to Habakkuk. So I don't know that Habakkuk wrote the story, but the idea that Jews are reading the story as something that derived not just from Judea, but from the prophet himself, I think is really, really fascinating. I love your connection with Yechezkel. I know of the image of Yechezkel being dragged, but I did not make that connection. So I really appreciate your making it. And I do absolutely think it's significant. So thank you for that.
I was thinking of the parallel with the book of Judges. Yeah. where the theme is the lack of central leadership again, and some of the stories, Shoshana, almost rape, and the story of the Pilegesh, who was indeed gang raped, the two at the very end of Judges, actually in Samuel, Hophni and Pinchas are two elders with authority who were evil as could be. They're all pointing to that there's got to be a center in Yerushalayim. And that's the point of both stories.
And what about in the beginning of Judges with the, oh my gosh, is it Dagon? The idol that falls on his face in the temple. And that's taken as a symbol of sort of the disproving of that idol. Gosh, it's early on.
It's the beginning of Samuel.
Samuel, thank you so much. I was looking at that. Thank you. So I think that's also very resonant in the scenes, in the little vignette scenes in Bell. So those early prophetic texts, I think, are definitely in the mind of the authors. Look, these writers knew their Septuagint. Wait, is it? Can someone give me a chapter here? I guess I'll have to look it up. I don't want to waste your time. I'll look it up later. But thought it was Judges. Okay. But absolutely, these are careful readers of the Septuagint who are borrowing elements from the stories. And I think you're right also to point to the end of Shoftim, to the end of Judges with Pilegesh Begiva. I think that would be very interesting to look at Shoshana through that story. Okay, Brian Sachs is raising his hand. So Brian, 1 Samuel 5, thank you. You're on mute.
Okay. To what extent do you think Daniel is a real historical figure, or is he just a legend?
I think these stories are legendary. I think the figure of Daniel could have easily existed. I think you would have to prove that he didn't, right? I think that, yes. That the onus would be on proving that he didn't. Just like Joseph, right? I would view as a historical figure. Does that mean that every story for centuries and centuries on circulating about these figures are exactly perfectly historical? You know, I don't know that they need to be. I think that also in this late Second Temple period, Jews aren't reading historical works the way that we read them in the 21st century. They're not reading them for, you know, precision and historical accuracy. They're reading them for message. And so Daniel, sure, I take as a historical figure, very, very important exilic Babylonian figure. The stories that are produced about him 3-4 centuries after his death, no, I don't read these stories as historical accounts of his adventures, but I read them as sort of fan fiction, the way that we might write stories about, I don't know, like George Washington saying, "I can never tell a lie," or the cherry tree. Like, are these stories that happened? No, but they're stories that we tell about very famous, important figures because they embody certain values. So I think these stories are, you know, when I say I don't read them as history, it doesn't mean I don't read them as significant. But I do think that Daniel as a figure likely was a historical person who becomes probably the most important figure besides Joseph in the diasporan imagination. Enormously, enormously important. Now, why I'm saying that is because we have to understand that when we read rabbinic literature, which takes these stories and then superimposes them onto the patriarchal narratives. Okay.
Yeah, there is a slight difference between Joseph and Daniel in that Joseph is more or less prehistory in terms of, whereas, you know, 6th century BCE is very much recorded history. So there's no question that Nebuchadnezzar or Cyrus are historical features. So there's no actual historical evidence for Daniel as compared to, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I mean, of course, right, that's true. Well, I want to make sure that Gerald, I don't know how to say your last name, so yes. I'm not going to. Gerald has a chance to talk, and then there was one other person, Bimia Reed, wanted to ask a question, then we'll wrap up. Actually, I don't think Mrs. Simi Peters is giving a talk after me, so I'm not in as big of a rush, but, you know, I want to respect your time. Okay, so Gerald, please.
Do you think that the rabbis had knowledge of these stories And that, for instance, the Shoshana story about Edim Zomamin comes through to the Talmud afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, it's
as a methodology?
Yeah, in chapter four. I do. Look, I don't think that the rabbis are walking around reading their Septuagint, memorizing passages of the Septuagint, but I think that these stories are circulating. I think this is, especially in the Babylonian rabbinic tradition, the figure of, I did talk about fan fiction, the figure of Daniel is enormously important. And so I do think that they were aware of a tradition of Susanna. Yeah. Yeah.
And they might have used it in order to build their own story about Edim Zomamin,
they use it in a legal context. They use it to derive halakha, which I think is very, very interesting, right? Like, how do you interrogate witnesses? How do you separate them? What questions do you ask? So that's interesting. You know, again, that's why I view Daniel as like a proto-rabbi. Now, it's dangerous to talk about that, because then there's a tendency to collapse the whole second temple period and then just jump from Daniel and Ezra, these proto-rabbis, and then sort of go straight to the Mishnah as if nothing happens in between. So I don't want to do that, except to say that the rabbis in a way are doing that. Because they are looking at these stories and saying, okay, so what do we do with them? Now they're being used in different ways in the late second temple period. There were false witnesses. Not so. Okay. All right. So one last question from Ms. Reed.
Hi. I was thinking of the term, because I've never heard this story about Habakkuk and being flown by the hair. It reminds me very much of that term Deus Ex Machina. And I was wondering, is that like sort of a Hellenistic thing? Like, you know, it's almost like you said, like a play, like all of a sudden, like the machine comes and you're flown across the stage. And like, why, like, where does that, is that where this, that kind of originates? Is this sort of biblical tradition here, at least from this Apocrypha period?
I'm not sure if I understand your question. Are you talking about this particular being dragged by the hair business?
Well, I mean, just sort of like how some, like a godlike figure is showing up to sort of save Daniel through, there'd be no other way that he would have gotten out, you know what I mean? And I'm wondering, is this sort of the genesis of that sort of tradition?
Oh, that's where so interesting.
The God of the machines like sort of pops up to save.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, it's very Hellenistic, because you have contemporaneous Hellenistic stories in which, you know, things are so, 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 so bad, they can't possibly get any worse. And that's when salvation comes. I would have to think about whether you have any earlier parallels in the Jewish tradition. That's a great question. And I don't know that I could answer it offhand. I can't think of any parallels offhand, but I would want to give it more thought. It's a great question.
Thank you.
Okay, so next week, we are going to talk about the story of the Hasmonean rebellion against the Syrian Greeks and the second century witnesses to that rebellion, one Maccabees and two Maccabees, although two Maccabees is not an eyewitness. If you attended my Torah in Motion class for Hanukkah, where I discuss a lot of these sources, there will be a lot of overlap. I'm just being honest with you. It's not identical to the Hanukkah talk I gave in December. There's a lot of overlap. If you were at that class and you remember it perfectly, I don't know that you need to come to the class on Monday. But like I said, it won't be identical. We'll be looking at one Maccabees, two Maccabees, situating ourselves really in that mid-second century BC context. The final class in the series will be on wisdom literature. I'll probably talk about Ben Sira, but I haven't made a final decision yet for what we're going to do in that class. Actually, I do want to say, for the last class of the series, I'd like to leave 20 minutes for conversation. I would like to make it more open. If you have any questions, comments, insights, I think maybe we'll make it a shorter class so we could have more conversation.
We'd rather hear you.
That's very kind. Well, let's play it by ear, and maybe I should prepare the class. And I'll decide exactly what we're going to do, and then
I'll second that.
Okay. So let's plan wisdom literature. I'll probably do Ben Sira and one or two other texts. Yeah. All righty. Thanks, everybody. Have a wonderful week.
Can I ask one last question on the way out?
Sure.
Do you have a reference for, like, some people have been really interested in the prophecies of Daniel, other groups actually, and the Jewish response to some of the stuff that's been written about
the Son of Man in the Christian tradition?
Yeah, some people are all over that. And I was wondering if you have a reference for a Jewish perspective on some of that stuff.
I would start with how the New Testament uses the phrase the Son of Man and then look at Jewish scholarship on that.
Okay.
Right. So why don't you take a look at, I know what you should look at. The Jewish Annotated New Testament, I think, has an article in the back, maybe not on the Son of Man, but on Messiahship in the first century and how Daniel is used.
Yes.
Take a look at that.
I have that, and I have read that.
Did you look at the essays in the back? So you saw that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, okay. I wanted a bit more detail, but I can keep looking. That's fine.
What about, what's his name at Yale? John Collins has written on Daniel. Look at John Collins. He wrote a book on Daniel.
Perfect.
And he talks extensively about the Son of Man. I don't know how much he does with like the early Christian church fathers, but
Dr. Jill Levine also has written extensively on this.
Yeah, not on Daniel though. She writes on it through the New Testament, I think, unless I'm missing something. But yeah.
Also through the prophets.
Through Daniel? Okay. So yeah, so A.J. Levine edited the Jewish Annotated New Testament, and she's done a lot of it through the first century context.
But okay.
Collins, exactly like Carla says, wrote a massive, massive commentary on Daniel. So I would go there. He's really, you know, like top scholar.
Great start. Thanks a million.
Yeah. Good luck. Yeah, I'll stay on for another minute.
Can I ask a question related to these texts, but actually a little bit on Esther from last week? Nowadays, it's often common to understand Esther, the Hebrew Esther, as a critique of the Jews who didn't go back to Judea. Do you know if that was a reading that was around in the Second Temple time in the same way as a critique of diaspora and Jewry?
Yeah. That's a great question. So I'm not totally, right, some of you are nodding, not totally compelled by that. I think that's really, I think could have been how later Jews read it. I'm not convinced that that's how it was read in the second temple period. I'm not. Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Leave it at that. Yeah. Well, you know how to reach me. I have been getting a lot of wonderful emails from you. If it takes me a few days to respond, I really appreciate your patience because I can't always respond right away, but I'd like to hear from you. So feel free to reach out if you have any questions.
Just quickly in response to Carol's question, Daniel Boyarin has written a lot about, I don't know specifically about Daniel, but certainly about Son of Man and its significance. And there's a book, Carol, I can lend it to you if I've got it on my shelf somewhere. So I can't remember the title.
Fantastic. Thanks, Bob.
I just finished reading Boyarin's Traveling Homeland on Shabbat. He's so brilliant, and I disagree with him so much. I guess that's a sign of like a really interesting scholar. All right, everybody. Take care and have a great week.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Bye. Thank you. Bye.